This is The Loving Project, a podcast celebrating the 50th anniversary of Loving v. Virginia.
In each episode, we hear from a different couple describing what it's like to be in an interracial marriage, 5 decades after the Supreme Court decision that struck down state laws prohibiting marriage between people of different races.
This time we hear from Joshua and Marlene. Joshua is white and Marlene is black. She was born in the Dominican Republic, but moved to the United States with her family when she was 9.
Joshua is a lawyer and Marlene's a doctor. They met online in 2011 and arranged to have their first date at a concert venue in Philadelphia called the TLA.
Unfortunately, there were a couple things that went wrong. One was the TLA, there's little to no seating, and Marlene wore high heels. And the show started very, very late. And the music was incredibly loud, so it was very hard to talk. And then it was also raining, and she was wearing custom-made Italian shoes, so her shoes were getting wet, and neither of us had an umbrella. So there were a lot of things that went wrong.
But a lot of things that went right, right? So he walked me back to my car, and I remember my feet were hurting because I had been standing on these heels, and like that wasn't his fault. That was my fault, right? Why did I wear these heels? Because I wanted to look good. But it was probably not the most practical choice, and he seemed like a really nice guy, but because my feet were hurting and I was wet and I was tired and I had to be at work, you know, at 6:30 in the morning the next day, I probably wasn't my most cheerful on the walk to my car. And so then I offered him a ride home and he took the ride. And then I dropped him off and he was being charming and making conversation. And it just took me kind of out of my funk. And he just turned to me at the end and said, "Hey, do you want to get together later this week or something?" And he smiled. And his dimples, and I don't think I had appreciated them until that point. And I thought he's just such a nice guy. You know, we should totally do something again. At that moment is when I thought that the date was a success. Up until then, I wasn't sure how things were going. I really appreciated that you didn't see the night as having been ruined, even though I was kind of heading in that direction for reasons that in retrospect are, you know, they're not important, right? Like the shoes, we salvaged them, but even if we didn't, you know, who cares? They're just shoes.
My name is Marlene, and I'm a Black Dominican.
My name is Joshu. I'm white, and we've been married since 2014.
So once the second date came around, I wore flats. I brought an umbrella because there was a chance of rain. And so did you.
I also brought an umbrella. And
it ended up being a great date.
Yes.
You took me to a fashion show.
So yeah, it was a little bit more highbrow experience, a little more comfortable, I think. We had seating.
So it was our second date, which was going really well. After the fashion show, we went and had drinks, and we were leaving, and
it's a long elevator ride, because I think it's on the 42nd floor.
Or something like that, and there was a man, and I guess he disapproved of the fact that it was a Black man who seemed to disapprove of the fact that I was with a white man, and he said something to Joshu, like, "What do you know about her hair?" Like, we maybe were talking about hair, so it wasn't a complete non sequitur, but we weren't talking with him. And certainly, you know, we were not inviting his comments, but he said something like, "What do you know about her hair?"
Yeah.
That really upset me. I didn't let it ruin the night, and you know, as I was kind of replaying the date in my mind and, you know, talking to my friends, et cetera, in my mind, I wondered, you know, is there going to be a lot more of this? And thankfully, I don't think there's been too much. I mean, I also think that we live in Philadelphia and we're a little bit sheltered from it. I don't remember any other like egregious comment or treatment.
Yeah, I think we're fortunate to not spend a lot of time worrying about it. And partly it's because we're very used to being in a social setting where interracial couples aren't uncommon. Which
it helps that many of our friends are
interracial relationships. Yeah, we don't stand out as much. Yeah, absolutely.
Do you remember back when we were dating early on, when I started telling you about the microaggressions that I would get, you know, at the supermarket or at work? Or
I remember our talking about it, and I know that you definitely were proactive about sharing your experience, and it opened a new window for me. You know, I'd talk to people here and there sort of about their experiences. I remember, for example, really vividly a friend of mine in college who was pre-med and she was taking chemistry, and the professor had been working with a substance that created a reaction and there was a white byproduct. And the professor said, "Because of affirmative action, now we need to do a reaction involving a Black substance." And something about it really just struck me, because I knew that, especially among the STEM departments, there was really very little diversity. And so to see somebody who was incredibly capable and motivated end up in a situation where they felt that their professor would make a mark like that, that might send a message to her that you don't belong here. And that really hit me. But the difference for me was that I heard about these stories in isolation, and talking to you on a day-to-day basis about your experiences being out beyond the world. Well, I think it really was important and really helpful for me to get a sense of how they all accumulate, even if in isolation they might be relatively low level, that there's like this cumulative impact that can really take a toll. That's something that I've started to kind of get on a more visceral level, as opposed to just sort of intellectually being aware that, you know, these things happen here and there.
So when things were getting serious between us, that's when I really started thinking about, okay, is this someone that I see a future with, right? And you, and I started thinking about his attributes and his qualities and, you know, all the wonderful things about him. But then I also started thinking, you know, is this someone that I can come home to and tell him about a microaggression and have him listen and not dismiss it? Because that's part of like everyday life, right? You come home and if something happens to you, you share it with the person that you live with, right? Can you believe, you know, like I dropped the eggs on the way here, you know? And someone says, oh, that really stinks.
What Marlene is saying, she tried to figure out if I was woke or not.
I did. And so I actually made it a point to tell him every time we saw each other. And we were seeing each other with increasing frequency. And at the beginning, I remember, you know, you were really trying to be optimistic. So Joshua is a very optimistic person. It's actually one of my favorite things about him. And he would ask, well, do you think that maybe they said this because of X or because of Y or because of whatever? And, you know, we've been together now since 2011. One of the biggest differences in how we've grown together is that I tell, you know, a couple of days ago, I came home and I told you, you know, I had an unpleasant interaction at a furniture store with someone who started to speak to me in a certain way that I only because I'm Black, like, and to use certain vernacular and like was being very familiar with me. And I was stunned and I was also really enraged. And I came home and I told Joshua about it. And it was wonderful because Joshua was just as mad as I was. He was just like, can you believe that? You know, and it feels wonderful to be able to come home and not to have to explain it. I can just say, this is what she said. And you know why it was inappropriate and hurtful and insulting.
Yeah.
So I really am thankful for that. Growing with Joshua and living with Joshua, especially the first few years when we were getting to know each other more, I could see how it's much easier to not think about race if you're white. And it doesn't make you a bad person. But I saw how it was much easier. Like, Joshua, you could go your whole day without thinking about race. If you did that, it would not negatively affect your day. You could still get everything that you needed to get done, and have a good day. You could have a good day. And so that's one thing that I've, that level of understanding, which I think is important if we are to have dialogues. We all need to talk about race, all of us, white people, Black people, Asian people, Latino people, like we all need to talk about race. And not all of us are doing it. And I think it's easier for certain people, like white people, to not do it. Now understanding and seeing why it's easier for them to not think about it, I think I'm a little bit more patient, but we still need to talk about it.
Before, the reason why I had to think about race primarily was because of my job. When we met, I was working as a prosecutor. And for me, increasingly as I did the job, it was impossible for me to not think about race when I was thinking about the criminal justice system. You know, I had friends who had sort of helped me to think more about how race serves as a backdrop for a lot of other things that aren't explicitly racial. But on a day-to-day basis, the thing that got me to really just seeing race as a thread in almost everything that we do was the professional aspect of it. So I think I was sort of headed in that direction. But I think what, you know, seeing the world through Marlene's eyes did was, it made it much more personal.
So So when things were getting serious between us, and right, and then you start thinking about, is this someone that I want to be serious with? And then you think about all the reasons that you would want to be serious with them and all the factors. And, you know, one of them, of course, that I felt like I needed to think about was the fact that we were of different backgrounds. But initially I didn't. It didn't make an impact.
Yeah, I would agree that's probably something that we didn't really start talking about a lot until we got much more serious and we were thinking about things like starting a family. But I don't think either of us ever felt that was a barrier in any way. I think partly because Marlene's comes from an Afro-Caribbean background, it's not as binary in terms of her cultural heritage. Within her family, she has a really wide spectrum of skin tones, and it's very natural for within the same family for folks to really look very different. You know, some people have wavy hair, some people have hair that's a little bit different texture. You'll have different skin tones, different facial features, and on down the line.
Although there's still a lot of colorism.
Oh, there's no question that people are judged by their appearance, but a family that is more blended, so to speak, I think is just totally common. In terms of your family members, I don't think anyone flinched.
That's correct.
And I suspect that, you know, it might be a little bit easier, you know, given, you know, your cultural heritage, that people are used to that. They have families that are a little bit more blended.
Maybe. So Joshua speaks Spanish well, very well. And I think that made a big difference, Joshua. I think my family, obviously knowing that I love and care about you, would have embraced you. But I think they embraced you so much just very quickly. And you've been able to really get to know each other on another level because you speak the same language. So my parents, their first language is Spanish. When we visit my family, when they come over to visit for holidays or whatnot, we are all speaking Spanish. And I think it helps a lot that you're able to partake in those conversations and you're able to communicate with them without having to have me as your interpreter.
I
think that probably has helped a lot in the uniting of our families.
Yeah. From my parents' standpoint, I know there wasn't really any issues at all. And I know Marlene had sort of just typical nervousness about meeting my family members. I don't know if any of it had to do with race.
Oh, absolutely.
But, you know, I assured her that it would be completely fine and she didn't believe me. And then she and my mom, you know, were best friends very quickly. But
initially I was really nervous. I mean, I asked you very, you know, before I met your family, do they know I'm not white?
I do remember that, yeah.
You have to ask.
Yes. No, it's a question you have to ask. And I think I come from a fairly open-minded family. You know, both my parents had experience of not following the prescribed path, you know, life path. So they were both sort of black sheep, particularly my mom, who's Jewish. Within her family, it was controversial that she didn't end up marrying a Jewish man. And so both of them had been on the receiving end of people who were intolerant. And I think that might have been formative for them just in terms of the way that they think and act. I've always really felt a connection to Caribbean culture for whatever reason. And I did some traveling and I studied for a semester at the University of Puerto Rico in college. So it was sort of just gradually, you know, my language skills deepened because it was something that I just found myself continually attracted to. But interestingly enough, I was not that familiar with Dominican culture in particular, which is very distinctive and really rich. And so I've had the opportunity to really broaden my horizons just through getting to know Marlene and her family.
He has more Dominican swag than I do.
Yeah. Well, you know, and that's one thing I think is that you don't really advertise your Dominican identity.
No,
not that you should be draping yourself in the flag or anything like that. There are some people who it's very important for them to not only feel Dominican or whatever their national heritage is, but to really broadcast it and signal it to others. And Marlene is not conspicuous about it, even though she has a very deeply rooted Dominican identity, I think.
I grew up thinking I'm Dominican, and that was my primary identity, and I was really married to that. as I've gotten more life experience, obviously, and matured and grown, I've come to realize that, yes, my ethnicity is that I am Dominican, and that is a very central part of my identity and the customs that we follow and, you know, the food that we eat and the way that I think about the world. That's definitely been formative. But at the same time, I can't ignore my race and, more importantly, the way that I'm perceived by the world. When I step outside, people don't look at me and say, oh, look, there's that Dominican girl walking down the street. I look like I am Black, right? My skin is brown. I have a big afro, medium-sized afro. I wish it were big. And that's how I'm perceived. I remember early in college having conversations about race with my college friends, and someone was like, but you're Black. And I was like, oh, no, I'm not Black. I'm Dominican, right? But I think at that moment, like a lot of people, I was equating Black with African-American. And so I am not African-American. I'm Black, but I'm also Dominican. And a lot of people don't know that I'm Dominican. And it's not like I don't publicize it, but like a lot of my colleagues sometimes express surprise when they hear me speaking in Spanish with a patient. And they wonder, oh, where did you learn Spanish? And I say, no, that's my first language. And then they're like, what? Then I say, yeah, did you know that I'm Dominican? And it, you know, everybody leaves more informed. People just assume, I think, for some reason, they assume I am African-American, you know, because I'm Black. They assume I'm African-American. Maybe because I have an Afro, they assume I'm African-American. But there are many Afro-Caribbeans. Most people in the Dominican Republic are my skin color or darker. So I've really come to embrace both.
Do you think it'd be fair to say that the popular American image of what Latinidad looks like
doesn't look
is
like
white?
Absolutely.
Or if not white, at least lighter shade.
Oh my God. Yeah. It's white. Straight long hair and, you know, like Sofia Vergara. Like, and I have nothing against any of these entertainers, you know, the power to them for being successful. But that's not all that being Latino is, or being Puerto Rican or Colombian, as Sofia Vergara is. So Joshua speaks Spanish, and one of his sisters speaks Spanish really well. Joshua's mom and dad do not speak Spanish. My family, my siblings speak English. My mom and my dad speak English, but they feel the most comfortable in Spanish. And so our families had a few joint holidays before we got married. And, you know, I was nervous because of the language barrier. I also didn't want to be everybody's sole interpreter. But it actually ended up working really well. So my mom and his mom will communicate. They use a lot of signs sometimes.
My dad and your mom are both very adept socially, and they find ways to communicate and connect with people despite barriers like that.
True. But because there is a language barrier, though, and because I wanted to honor my Dominican roots, it was important for us to have a bilingual wedding, which opens up a can of logistics, right? No one wants a really long wedding ceremony. They love you, they come to your wedding, but they don't want to sit there for an hour. And you don't want to translate everything, right? So, because then it's kind of redundant, and then half the people are just waiting while the other half is understanding. So that took some planning. But we had a dear friend of ours who is Dominican and works as an interpreter, be our officiant. And so he was able to officiate in both languages. And then we had different members of our family do readings, some in English, some in Spanish. And we said our vows in English, but we provided a Spanish translation in the program because we really wanted to keep it to like 20 to 25 minutes. So, and we had American music, and we also had some Dominican merengue and salsa. And we tried to make sure everybody felt included. So I've always known I was going to have Black kids because I'm Black. But I wonder now, right? So when you have mixed race kids, right, they can be very, very fair skinned, and they can, you know, be medium. They can be very dark skinned. So I wonder if we have kids and they look white, I worry that people won't think they're mine, because I read about this on, you know, blogs on the internet. You know, if people come up to me and just assume I'm the nanny always, it's really going to get to me. And it's silly for me to worry about it because I have no control about it, right? They're going to come out how they're going to come out, and I'm going to love them. But I hope that they have some melanin so that people can see that they could be related to me in some way. Because men don't get it, right? So if Joshua were walking around with two brown-skinned kids with little afros, no one's going to go up to him and say, oh, are you the nanny? How much do you charge, right? And I hope they are somewhere in between and they, you know, look like both of us. But if people think I'm the nanny day in and day out, I know it's going to be a point of like another little sore spot. Things were a lot more difficult back before Loving. Unfortunately, we still have challenges. Seeing all the news and all the videos of Black people, particularly Black men, but both Black men and women being the recipients of violence from police, and then not seeing those officers held accountable, et cetera. It's something that hits really close to home when we're thinking about trying to start a family. You know, I understand our kids are going to be biracial and bicultural, but they're probably just going to be seen as Black, right? I mean, we try to imagine scenarios like, what would we do? How would we react if there is bias in the classroom? I mean, just like little things compared to, you know, the big things that I was just talking about, like men and women being killed. But we know that there's evidence there that kids of color are suspended more frequently than their white counterparts, or are sometimes not promoted to the advanced classes at the same rate, even if they have the same accomplishments, et cetera. You know, kind of lower level, but still significant issues that we talk about. And I really hope, you know, if and when these things arise, you know, I want us both to be able to stand up for our children. But I think Joshua was a white man. I hope he's going to use that social standing to get justice for our family and make sure that our children are treated fairly.
Yeah, it's something that I do think about. And I think that in the same way that being married to somebody who's Black has affected the way that I look at the world, I think the prospect of being a father to a mixed race son or daughter also makes me look at the world differently. I pay more attention to things that affect kids of color. And then when I think about it, I think a little bit differently. And it's because it directly affects me.
Do you feel like I'm putting you on the spot in the future?
Yeah, so that idea that because I have certain social status based upon my identity, that makes me uniquely able to advocate. I mean, to me, that's just self-evident. And I don't see any problem with that. I know that when I was in college, I was an American Studies major, and the 1960s was one of the main things that I focused on. And I was fascinated by that era and how we managed a lot of difficult issues that we face. I mean, that was the last time we had a really difficult conversation nationally about race, was about 50 years ago. And that was the period that gave us the Voting Rights Act, it gave us the Civil Rights Act, it gave us Loving versus Virginia, it gave us Brown versus Board of Education. And when I look back at that, you needed a white U.S. Supreme Court to decide Brown and to decide Loving. There were no non-white members of the court. And so I say that because you needed a U.S. Supreme Court that was willing to make tough decisions relating to race, despite the fact that they themselves were all white. There wasn't somebody Black that could take those steps to move us forward on these really difficult issues. And so as far as I'm concerned, there's no way around it that if we're going to make progress on race, that it has to be a joint effort.
50 years is not that long of a time. And I think it's human nature to take for granted what you have, right? So take for granted that Joshua asked me to marry him and I said, sure. And then we got married and look, life is pretty good. But 50 years is not that long of time. And so the thought that it was illegal 50 years ago is a little bit of a, like, it kind of shakes my world a little bit, because I know, right, we all know just because it was made legal didn't mean that it was socially accepted, right? The people who like tried to get married, you know, 48 years ago didn't have it that much easier, right? It was just legal. I'm grateful for those people who fought the fight back then so that it's legal now. But we still have a lot of challenges, as evidenced, you know, by our social and political climate right now.
The fact that loving occurred only 50 years ago, I think is very impactful. All four of our parents were alive then. And so it was during their lifetimes. It's also interesting that we didn't get loving until we'd already settled a lot of other racial and legal issues. All of those, all the legislation and cases that I mentioned before, they all happened first. So there is something about it that feels really deeper and momentous. And I think part of it is just we're talking about regulating one of the most intimate and personal aspects of life. And I think for most people, it didn't escape them the parallels with the more recent gay marriage cases, because ultimately, it's not just a value judgment when you say who can marry and who can't. It's much more beyond that, because giving folks the right to marry gives them legal privileges. And so
it also affords them equality, right? It says, like, we're the same, right? So we, heterosexual couple, are the same as this same-sex couple. You put yourself at the same level.
Well, that's where I was going with it, is when you say there are certain legal privileges that are unavailable to you, it's not just saying this is something that we disapprove of as a society. It's not just a value judgment, but it's also a deprivation. And we create laws and we maintain laws as a reflection of our values. But it goes the other way, that if you codify in law that somebody is less than, that sends a message to people as they're forming their worldviews. Well, if the law says that some people are somehow less than, or they're not accorded these legal rights and privileges, then how could you look upon it as fully legitimate? And so to me, that's really important, is that for us to really heal, you know, some of those social wounds, I think it's a necessary step that you get to that point where legally you can recognize something as legitimate.
No matter how much you think you know someone, we all have biases, right? So the day after the election, when the polls started to come through and the breakdown of, you know, who voted for Trump, I was distraught. So it's pretty obvious I did not vote for Trump. And I was really, really, really distraught, and I hadn't slept. We had stayed up really late, so I wasn't in my right mind. But I, for a moment, I questioned who Joshua voted for, and I turned to him and I said, did you vote for Trump? It was a kind of a ridiculous question, and I realized that, but I was in tears when I asked him. I was so upset, I couldn't believe it. And in my mind, I kept asking, you know, what person that I thought wasn't going to vote for Trump voted for Trump, and am I married to that person? That was a really low moment for me. I know you didn't. And I mean, I was beside myself. I was like, so did you take a photo of who you voted for? To which Joshua said something like, that's illegal in Pennsylvania. Which is, like, of course what Joshua would say. But I wasn't even thinking straight. I felt betrayed. And at that moment, it was so low, I suspected someone who I know would never do that when I'm in my right mind.
Well, we both found out that there are people that had friendly relationships with who we didn't think would vote for a virulently racist and misogynistic presidential candidate. And it turns out that somehow they did.
True. So it wasn't, I wasn't coming totally out of left field, but
it was statistically justified because a whole bunch of white people did vote for Trump, but I was probably the wrong person to suspect.
you were the first white person I saw that day.
Sure.
I'm sorry.
Apology accepted.
We'd like to thank Marlene and Joshu for sharing their story with us.
You can find out more about the Loving Project at our website, lovingproject.com. That's where you'll also find more episodes of the podcast, pictures of some of the couples profiled on the show, and links to follow us on Twitter and Facebook.
The Loving Project's available in iTunes, Google Play, and just about anywhere else you find podcasts. And if you like the show, please consider leaving a review. I'm Brad Linder.
And I'm Farrah Parks. Thanks for listening to The Loving Project.
In the next episode of The Loving Project, we'll hear from me and Ken.
Me is Korean-American, and Ken is white and Irish. He emigrated to the U.S. after the two had been dating long distance for a few years.
During the immigration process, he got a crash course in some of the assumptions Americans make based on race.
Half the time we would go to an immigration interview and it would be assumed that I was not the interviewee.
Right, they would always assume I was the immigrant. I think every single time. Before they would pull out the paperwork.
Ken and me's story, coming up next time on The Loving Project.